be brief. My eyes have told me that you have questions. Questions that no mortal has the right to ask. About the keys. Legend said Maeve could commune with the spirit world. Had Elena or Nehemia told her? Selena opened her mouth, but Maeve held up a hand. I will give you those answers. You may come to me in Doranelle to receive them. Why not? A growl from Rowan at the interruption. Because they are answers that require time, Maeve said. Then slowly added, as if she savored every word, and answers you have not yet earned. Tell me what I can do to earn them, and I will do it. Fool. A damned fool's response. A dangerous thing to offer without hearing the price. You want me to show you my magic? I'll show it to you. But not here. Not... I have no interest in seeing you drop your magic at my feet like a sack of grain. I want to see what you can do with it, Aelin Galathinius, which currently seems like not very much at all. Selena's stomach tightened at that cursed name. I want to see what you will become under the right circumstances. I do not permit mortals or half-breeds into Doranelle. For a half-breed to enter my realm, she must prove herself both gifted and worthy. Mistward, this fortress, she waved a hand to encompass the room, is one of several proving grounds, and a place where those who do not pass the test can spend their days. Beneath the growing fear, a flicker of disgust went through her. Half-breed. Maeve said it with such disdain. And what manner of test might I expect before I am deemed worthy? Maeve gestured to Rowan, who had not moved from the door. You shall come to me once Prince Rowan decides that you have mastered your gifts. He shall train you here. And you shall not set foot in Doranelle until he deems your training complete. After facing the horseshit she'd seen in the glass castle, demons, witches, the king, training with Rowan, even in magic, seemed rather anticlimactic. But it could take weeks, months, years. The familiar fog of nothing crept in, threatening to smother her once again. She pushed it back long enough to say, What I need to know isn't something that can wait. You want answers regarding the keys, heir of Terrasen? Then they shall be waiting for you in Doranelle. The rest is up to you. Truthfully, Selena blurted, you will truthfully answer my questions about the keys. Maeve smiled, and it was not a thing of beauty. You haven't forgotten all of our ways, then. When Selena didn't react, Maeve added, I will truthfully answer all of your questions about the keys. It might be easier to walk away. Go find some other ancient being to pester for the truth. Selena breathed in and out. In and out. But Maeve had been there. Had been there at the dawn of this world during the Volg Wars. She had held the word keys. She knew what they looked like, how they felt. Maybe she even knew where Brannon had hidden them. Especially the last unnamed key. And if Selena could find a way to steal the keys from the king, to destroy him, to stop his armies and free Eelwey, even if she could find just one word key, what manner of training? Prince Rowan shall explain the specifics. For now, he will escort you to your chamber to rest. Selena looked Maeve straight in her death-dealing eyes. You swear you'll tell me what I need to know? I do not break my promises. And I have the feeling that you are unlike your mother in that regard, too. Bitch. Bitch, she wanted to hiss. But then Maeve's eyes flicked to Selena's right palm. She knew everything. Through whatever spies or power or guesswork, Maeve knew everything about her and the vow to Nehemia.
To what end?
Selena asked softly, the anger and the fear dragging her down into an inescapable exhaustion. You want me to train only so I can make a spectacle of my talents? Maeve ran a moon-white finger down the owl's head. I wish you to become who you were born to be. To become queen. Become queen. The words haunted Selena that night. Kept her from sleeping. Even though she was so exhausted, she could have wept for the dark-eyed Silba to put her out of her misery. Queen. The word throbbed right along with the fresh split lip that also made sleeping very uncomfortable. She could thank Rowan for that. After Maeve's command, Selena hadn't bothered with goodbyes before walking out. Rowan had only cleared the way because Maeve gave him a nod, and he followed Selena into a narrow hallway that smelled of roasting meat and garlic. Her stomach grumbled. But she'd probably hurl her guts up the second she swallowed anything. So she trailed Rowan down the corridor, down the stairs, each footstep alternating between iron-willed control and growing rage. Left.
Nehemia.
Right.
You made a vow, and you will keep it by whatever means necessary.
Left.
Training. Queen.
Right.
Bitch. Manipulative, cold-blooded, sadistic bitch.
Ahead of her, Rowan's own steps were silent on the dark stones of the hallway. The torches hadn't been lit yet, and in the murky interior she could hardly tell he was there. But she knew, if only because she could almost feel the ire radiating off him. Good. At least one other person wasn't particularly thrilled about this bargain.
Training.
Training. Her whole life had been training, from the moment she was born. Rowan could train her until he was blue in the face, and as long as it got her the answers about the word keys, she'd play along. But it didn't mean that, when the time came, she had to do anything. Certainly not take up her throne. She didn't even have a throne, or a crown, or a court. Didn't want them. And she could bring down the king as Selena Sardothian, thank you very much. She tightened her fingers into fists. They encountered no one as they descended a winding staircase and started down another corridor. Did the residents of this fortress, Mistward, Maeve had called it, know who was in that study upstairs? Maeve probably got off on terrifying them. Maybe she had all of them, half-breeds, she called them, enslaved through some bargain or another. Disgusting. It was disgusting to keep them here just for having a mixed heritage. That was no fault of theirs. Selena finally opened up her mouth. You must be very important to her immortal majesty if she put you on nurse duty.
Given your history, she didn't trust anyone but her best to keep you in line.
Oh, the prince wanted to tangle. Whatever self-control he'd had on their trek to the fortress was hanging by a thread. Good. Playing warrior in the woods doesn't seem like the greatest indicator of talent.
I fought on killing fields long before you, your parents, or your granduncle were even born.
She bristled, exactly like he wanted.
Who's to fight here except birds and beasts?
Silence. Then,
the world is a far bigger and more dangerous place than you can imagine, girl. Consider yourself blessed to receive any training, to have the chance to prove yourself.
I've seen plenty of this big and dangerous world, Princeling. A soft, harsh laugh.
Just wait, Aelin.
Another jab, and she let herself fall for it. Don't call me that.
It's your name. I'm not going to call you anything different.
She stepped in his path, getting right near those two sharp canines. No one here can know who I am. Do you understand? His green eyes gleamed, animal bright in the dark.
My aunt has given me a harder task than she realizes, I think.
My aunt, not our aunt. And then she said one of the foulest things she'd ever uttered in her life, bathing in the pure hate of it. Fae like you make me understand the King of Otterland's actions a bit more, I think. Faster than she could sense, faster than anything had a right to be, he punched her. She shifted enough to keep her nose from shattering, but took the blow on her mouth. She hit the wall, whacked her head, and tasted blood. Good. He struck again with that immortal speed, or would have, but with equally unnerving swiftness, he halted his second blow before it fractured her jaw and snarled in her face, low and vicious. Her breathing turned ragged as she purred. Do it. He looked more interested in ripping out her throat than in talking, but he held the line he'd drawn.
Why should I give you what you want?
You're just as useless as the rest of your brethren. He let out a soft, lethal laugh that raked claws down her temper.
If you're that desperate to eat stone, go ahead. I'll let you try to land the next punch.
She knew better than to listen. But there was such a roar in her blood that she could no longer see right, think right, breathe right. So she damned the consequences to hell as she swung. Selena hit nothing but air. Air. And then his foot hooked behind hers in an efficient maneuver that sent her careening into the wall once more. Impossible. He'd tripped her as if she was nothing more than a trembling novice. He was now a few feet away, arms crossed. She spat blood and swore. He smirked. It was enough to send her hurtling for him again, to tackle or pummel or strangle him, she didn't know. She caught his left feint, but when she dove right, he moved so swiftly that despite her lifetime of training, she crashed into a darkened brazier behind him. The clatter echoed through the too quiet hall as she landed face first on the stone floor, her teeth singing.
Like I said, Rowan sneered down at her. You have a lot to learn. About everything.
Her lip already aching and swollen, she told him exactly what he could go do to himself. He sauntered down the hall.
Next time you say anything like that,
he said without looking over his shoulder,
I'll have you chopping wood for a month.
Fuming, hatred and shame already burning her face, Selena got to her feet. He dumped her in a very small, very cold room that looked like little more than a prison cell, letting her take all of 2 steps inside before he said,
Give me your weapons.
Why? And no. Like hell she'd give him her daggers. In a swift movement, he grabbed a bucket of water from beside her door and tossed the contents onto the hall floor before holding it out.
Give me your weapons.
Training with him would be absolutely wonderful. Tell me why.
I don't have to explain myself to you.
Then we're going to have another brawl. His tattoo seeming impossibly darker in the dim hall, he stared at her beneath lowered brows as if to say, You call that a brawl? But instead he growled,
Starting at dawn, you'll earn your keep by helping in the kitchen. Unless you plan to murder everyone in the fortress, there is no need for you to be armed, or to be armed while we train. So I'll keep your daggers until you've earned them back.
Well, that felt familiar. The kitchen?
He bared his teeth in a wicked grin.
Everyone pulls their weight here, princesses included. No one's above some hard labor, least of all you.
And didn't she have the scars to prove it? Not that she'd tell him that. She didn't know what she'd do if he learned about Endovir and mocked her for it, or pitied her. So my training includes being a scullery maid?
Part of it.
Again, she could have sworn she could read the unspoken words in his eyes. And I'm going to savor every damn second of your misery. For an old bastard, you certainly haven't bothered to learn manners at any point in your long existence. Never mind that he looked to be in his late 20s.
Why should I waste flattery on a child who's already in love with herself?
We're related, you know.
We've as much blood in common as I do with the fortress pig boy.
She felt her nostrils flare, and he shoved the bucket in her face. She almost knocked it right back into his, but decided that she didn't want a broken nose and began disarming herself. Rowan counted every weapon she put in the bucket as though he'd already learned how many she'd been carrying, even the hidden ones. Then he tucked the bucket against his side and slammed the door without so much of a goodbye beyond,
"Be ready at dawn."
"Bastard. Old stinking bastard," she muttered, surveying the room. A bed, a chamber pot, and a wash basin with icy water. She debated a bath, but opted to use the water to clean out her mouth and tend to her lip. She was starving, but going to find food involved meeting people. So once she'd mended her lip as best she could with the supplies in her satchel, she tumbled into bed, reeking vagrant clothes and all, and lay there for several hours. There was one small window with no coverings in her room. Selena turned over in bed to look through it to the patch of stars above the trees surrounding the fortress. Lashing out at Rowan like that? Saying the things she did? Trying to fight with him? She deserved that punch. More than deserved it. If she was being honest with herself, she was barely passable as a human being these days. She fingered her split lip and winced. She scanned the night sky until she located the stag, the Lord of the North. The unmoving star atop the stag's head, the eternal crown, pointed the way to Terrasen. She'd been told that the great rulers of Terrasen turned into those bright stars, so their people would never be alone, and would always know the way home. She hadn't set foot there in 10 years. While he'd been her master, Aerobin hadn't let her. And afterward, she hadn't dared. She had whispered the truth that day at Nehemia's grave. She'd been running for so long that she didn't know what it was to stand and fight. Selena loosed a breath and rubbed her eyes. What Maeve didn't understand, what she could never understand, was just how much that little princess in Terrasen had damned them a decade ago. Even worse than Maeve herself had. She had damned them all, and then left the world to burn into ash and dust. So Selena turned away from the stars, nestling under the threadbare blanket against the frigid cold, and closed her eyes, trying to dream of a different world. A world where she was no one at all.
Chapter 9. Manon Blackbeak stood on a cliff beside the snow-swollen river, eyes closed as the damp wind bit her face. There were few sounds she enjoyed more than the groans of dying men, but the wind was one of them. Leaning into the breeze was the closest she came to flying these days, save in rare dreams, when she was again in the clouds, her ironwood broom still functioning, not the scrap of useless wood it was now, chucked into the closet of her room at Blackbeak Keep. It had been 10 years since she'd tasted mist and cloud and ridden on the back of the wind. Today would have been a flawless flying day, the wind wicked and fast. Today she would have soared. Behind her, Mother Blackbeak was still talking with the enormous man from the caravan who called himself a duke. It had been more than coincidence, she supposed, that soon after she'd left that blood-soaked field in Fenharrow, she'd received a summons from her grandmother. And more than coincidence that she'd been not 40 miles from the rendezvous point just over the border in Otterlin. Manon was on guard duty while her grandmother, the High Witch of the Blackbeak clan, spoke to the Duke beside the raging Acanthus River. The rest of her coven had taken their positions around the small encampment. 12 other witches, all around Manon's age, all of them raised and trained together. Like Manon, they had no weapons, but it seemed that the Duke knew enough to realize Blackbeaks didn't need weapons to be deadly. You didn't need a weapon at all when you were born one. And when you were one of Manon's 13, with whom she had fought and flown for the past 100 years, often just the name of the coven was enough to send enemies fleeing. The 13 did not have a reputation for mercy, or making mistakes. Manon eyed the armored guards around the camp. Half were watching the Blackbeak witches, the others monitoring the Duke and her grandmother. It was an honor that the High Witch had chosen the 13 to guard her. No other coven had been summoned. No other coven was needed if the 13 were present. Manon slid her attention to the nearest guard. His sweat, the faint tang of fear, and the heavy musk of exhaustion drifted toward her. From the look and smell of it, they'd been traveling for weeks. There were 2 prison wagons with them. One emitted a very distinct male odor, and perhaps a remnant of cologne. One was female. Both smelled wrong. Manon had been born soulless, her grandmother said. Soulless and heartless, as a Blackbeak ought to be. She was wicked right down to the marrow of her bones. But the people in those wagons, and the Duke, they smelled wrong. Different. Alien. The nearby guard shifted on his feet. She gave him a smile. His hand tightened on the hilt of his sword. Because she could, because she was growing bored, Manon cocked her jaw, sending her iron teeth snapping down. The guard took a step back, his breath coming faster, the acrid tang of fear sharpening. With her moon-white hair, alabaster skin, and burnt-gold eyes, she'd been told by ill-fated men that she was beautiful as a fae queen. But what those men realized too late was that her beauty was merely a weapon in her natural-born arsenal. And it made things so, so fun. Feet crunched in the snow, and bits of dead grass, and Manon turned from the trembling guard and the roaring brown acanthus to find her grandmother approaching. In the 10 years since magic had vanished, their aging process had warped. Manon herself was well over a century old, but until 10 years ago she had looked no older than 16. Now she looked to be in her mid-20s. They were aging like mortals, they had soon realized with no small amount of panic. And her grandmother. The rich, voluminous midnight robes of Mother Blackbeak flowed like water in the crisp breeze. Her grandmother's face was now marred with the beginnings of wrinkles, her ebony hair sprinkled with silver. The High Witch of the Blackbeak clan wasn't just beautiful. She was alluring. Even now, with mortal years pressing down upon her bone-white skin, there was something entrancing about the matron. "We leave now," Mother Blackbeak said, walking north along the river. Behind them, the Duke's men closed ranks around the encampment. Smart for mortals to be so cautious when the 13 were present, and bored. One jerk of the chin from Manon was all it took for the 13 to fall in line. The 12 other sentinels kept the required distance behind Manon and her grandmother, footsteps near silent in the winter grass. None of them had been able to find a single crocken in the months they'd been infiltrating town after town, and Manon fully expected some form of punishment for it later. Flogging, perhaps a few broken fingers. Nothing too permanent, but it would be public. That was her grandmother's preferred method of punishment. Not the how, but the humiliation. Yet her grandmother's gold-flecked black eyes, the heirloom of the Blackbeak clan's purest bloodline, were bent on the northern horizon, toward Oakwald Forest and the towering white fangs far beyond. The gold-speckled eyes were the most cherished trait in their clan for a reason Manon had never bothered to learn, and when her grandmother had seen that Manon's were wholly of pure dark gold, the matron had carried her away from her daughter's still-cooling corpse and proclaimed Manon as her undisputed heir. Her grandmother kept walking, and Manon didn't press her to speak, not unless she wanted her tongue ripped clean from her mouth. "We're to travel north," her grandmother said, when the encampment was swallowed up by the foothills. "I want you to send 3 of your 13 south, west, and east. They are to seek out our kith and kin, and inform them that we will all assemble in the Farian Gap. Every last Blackbeak, no witch or sentinel left behind." Nowadays, there was no difference. Every witch belonged to a coven and was therefore a sentinel. Since the downfall of their western kingdom, since they had started clawing for their survival, every Blackbeak, Yellowlegs, and Blueblood had to be ready to fight, ready at any time to reclaim their lands or die for their people. Manon herself had never set foot in the former witch kingdom, had never seen the ruins or the flat green expanse that stretched to the western sea. None of her 13 had seen it either, all of them wanderers and exiles thanks to a curse from the last Kraken Queen as she bled out on that legendary battlefield. The matron went on, still staring at the mountains. "And if your sentinels see members of the other clans, they are to inform them to gather in the gap too. No fighting, no provoking. Just spread the word." Her grandmother's iron teeth flashed in the afternoon sun. Like most of the ancient witches, the ones who had been born in the Witch Kingdom and fought in the Iron Teeth Alliance to shatter the chains of the Kraken Queens, Mother Blackbeak wore her iron teeth permanently on display. Manon had never seen them retracted. Manon bit back her questions. The Farian Gap, the deadly blasted bit of land between the White Fang and Rune Mountains, and one of the few passes between the fertile lands of the east and the western wastes. Manon had made the passage through the snow-crusted labyrinth of caves and ravines on foot, just once, with the 13 and 2 other covens, right after magic had vanished, when they were all nearly blind, deaf, and dumb with the agony of suddenly being grounded. Half of the other witches hadn't made it through the gap. The 13 had barely survived, and Manon had almost lost an arm to an ice cavern cave-in. Almost lost it, but kept it thanks to the quick thinking of Astarin, her second in command, and the brute strength of Sorrel, her third. The Farian Gap. Manon hadn't been back since. For months now, there had been rumors of far darker things than witches dwelling there. "Baba Yellowlegs is dead." Manon whipped her head to her grandmother, who was smiling faintly. "Killed in Rifthold. The Duke received word. No one knows who or why." "Krokins?" "Perhaps." Mother Blackbeak's smile spread, revealing iron teeth spotted with rust. "The King of Otterlin has invited us to assemble in the Farian Gap. He says he has a gift for us there." Manon considered what she knew about the vicious, deadly king hell-bent on conquering the world. Her responsibility as both coven leader and heir was to keep her grandmother alive. It was instinct to anticipate every pitfall, every potential threat. "It could be a trap, to gather us in one place and then destroy us. He could be working with the Krokins, or perhaps the Bluebloods. They've always wanted to make themselves high witches of every Iron Teeth clan." "Oh, I think not," Mother Blackbeak purred, her depthless ebony eyes crinkling.
For the king has made us an offer. Made all the Iron Teeth clans an offer.
Manon waited, even though she could have gutted someone just to ease the miserable impatience.
The king needs riders,
Mother Blackbeak said, still staring at the horizon.
Riders for his wyverns. To be his aerial cavalry. He's been breeding them in the gap all these years.
It had been a while. Too damn long. But Manon could feel the threads of fate twisting around them. Tightening.
And when we are done, when we have served him, he will let us keep the wyverns. To take our host. To reclaim the wastes from the mortal pigs who now dwell there.
A fierce, wild thrill pierced Manon's chest, sharp as a knife. Following the matron's gaze, Manon looked to the horizon, where the mountains were still blanketed with winter. To fly again, to soar through the mountain passes, to hunt down prey the way they'd been born to. They weren't enchanted ironwood brooms, but wyverns would do just fine. Chapter 10. After a grueling day of training new recruits, avoiding Dorian, and keeping well away from the king's watchful eye, Kaol was almost at his rooms, more than ready to sleep, when he noticed that two of his men were missing from their posts outside the great hall. The two remaining men winced as he stopped dead. It wasn't unusual for guards to occasionally miss a shift. If someone was sick, if they had some family tragedy, Kaol always found a replacement. But two missing guards with no replacement in sight.
Someone had better start talking,
he ground out. One of them cleared their throats. A newer guard, who had just finished his training 3 months before. The other one was relatively new, too, which was why he'd assigned them to night duty outside the empty Great Hall. But he'd put them under the supposedly responsible and watchful eyes of the two other guards, both of whom had been there for years. The guard who'd cleared his throat went red.
Captain, they said that no one would really notice if they were gone since it's the Great Hall and it's empty and,
Use your words, Kaol snapped. He was going to murder the two deserters.
The general's party, sir, said the other. General Ashriver walked past on his way into Rifthold and invited them to join him. He said it would be all right with you, so they went with him.
A muscle feathered in his jaw. Of course Adian did.
And you too, Kaol growled. Didn't think it would be useful to report this to anyone?
With all due respect, sir, said the second one. We didn't want them to think we were ratters, and it's just the Great Hall.
Wrong thing to say,
Kaol snarled.
You're both on double duty for a month, in the gardens,
where it was still freezing.
Your leisure time is now non-existent, and if you ever again fail to report another guard abandoning his post, you're both gone. Understood?
When he got a mumbled confirmation, he stalked toward the front gate of the castle. Like hell he'd go to sleep now. He had two guards to hunt down in Rifthold, and a general to exchange some words with. Adian had rented out an entire tavern. Men were at the door to keep out the riffraff, but one glare from Kaol, one glimpse of the eagle-shaped pommel of his sword, had them stepping aside. The tavern was crammed with various nobles, some women who could have been courtesans or courtiers, and men. Lots of drunk, boisterous men. Card games, dice, body singing to the music made by the small quintet by the roaring fire, free-flowing taps of ale, bottles of sparkling wine. Was Adian going to pay for this with his blood money, or was it on the king? Kaol spotted his two guards, plus a half-dozen others, playing cards, women in their laps, grinning like fiends, until they saw him. They were still groveling as Kaol sent them packing. Back to the castle, where he would deal with them tomorrow. He couldn't decide whether they deserved to lose their positions, since Adian had lied. And he didn't like making choices like that unless he'd slept on them first. So out they went, into the freezing night. And then Kaol began the process of hunting down the general. But no one knew where he was. First, someone sent Kaol upstairs to one of the tavern's bedrooms, where he indeed found the two women someone said Adian had slipped away with, but another man was between them. Kaol only demanded where the general had gone. The women said they'd seen him playing dice in the cellar with some masked high-ranking nobles, so Kaol stormed down there. And indeed, there were the masked high-ranking nobles. They were pretending to be mere revelers, but Kaol recognized them anyway, even if he didn't call them out by name. They insisted Adian was last seen playing the fiddle in the main room. So Kaol went back upstairs. Adian was certainly not playing the fiddle, or the drum, or the lute, or the pipes. In fact, it seemed that Adian Ashripper wasn't even at his own party. A courtesan prowled up to him to sell her wares, and would have stalked away at his snarl had Kaol not offered her a silver coin for information about the general. She'd seen him leave an hour ago, on the arm of one of her rivals. Headed off to a more private location, but she didn't know where. If Adian was no longer here, then... Kaol went back to the castle. But he did hear one more bit of information. The Bane would arrive soon, people said. And when the Legion descended on the city, they planned to show Rifthold a whole new level of debauchery. All of Kaol's guards were invited, apparently. It was the last thing he wanted or needed. An entire legion of lethal warriors wreaking havoc on Rifthold and distracting his men. If that happened, the king might look too closely at Kaol, or ask where he sometimes disappeared to. So he needed to have more than just words with Adian. He needed to find something to use against him, so Adian would agree not to throw these parties and swear to keep his bane under control. Tomorrow night, he'd go to whatever party Adian threw, and see what leverage he could find. Chapter 11. Freezing and aching from shivering all night, Selena awoke before dawn in her miserable little room, and found an ivory tin sitting outside the door. It was filled with a salve that smelled of mint and rosemary, and beneath it was a note written in tight, concise letters. You deserved it. Maeve sends her wishes for a speedy recovery. Snorting at the lecture Rowan must have received, and how it must have ruffled his feathers to bring her the gift, Selena smeared the salve onto her still swollen lip. A glance in the speckled shard of mirror above the dresser revealed that she had seen better days, and was never drinking wine or eating tegya again, or going more than a day without a bath. Apparently Rowan agreed, because he'd also left a few pitchers of water, some soap, and a new set of clothes. White underthings, a loose shirt, and a pale gray surcoat and cloak similar to what he had worn the day before. Though simple, the fabric was thick and of good quality. Selena washed as best she could, shaking with the cold leaking in from the misty forest beyond. Suddenly homesick for the giant bathing pool at the palace, she quickly dried and slid into the clothes, thankful for the layers. Her teeth wouldn't stop chattering. Hadn't stopped chattering all night, actually. Having wet hair now didn't help, even after she'd braided it back. She stuffed her feet into the knee-high leather boots and tied the thick red sash around her waist as tightly as she could manage, without losing the ability to move, hoping to give herself some shape, but... Selena scowled at the mirror. She'd lost weight. Enough so that her face looked about as hollow as she felt. Even her hair had become rather dull and limp. The salve had already taken down the swelling in her lip, but not the color. At least she was clean again,
if frozen to her core, and completely overdressed for kitchen duty. Sighing, she unwrapped her sash and shrugged off the overcoat, tossing them onto the bed. Gods, her hands were so cold that the ring on her finger was slipping and sliding about. She knew it was a mistake, but she looked at it anyway, the amethyst dark in the early morning light. What would Kaol make of all this? She was here, after all, because of him. Not just here in this physical place, but here inside this endless exhaustion, the near constant ache in her chest. It was not his fault that Nehemia had died, not when the princess had orchestrated everything. Yet he had kept information from her. He had chosen the king. Even though he'd claimed he loved her, he still loyally served that monster. Maybe she'd been a fool for letting him in, for dreaming of a world where she could ignore the fact that he was captain to the man who had shattered her life again and again. The pain in her chest sharpened enough that breathing became difficult. She stood there for a moment, pushing back at it, letting it sink into the fog that smothered her soul, and then trudged out the door. The one benefit to scullery duty was that the kitchen was warm, hot even. The great brick oven and hearth were blazing, chasing away the morning mist that slithered in from the trees beyond the bay of windows above the copper sinks. There were only two other people in the kitchen, a hunched old man tending to the bubbling pots on the hearth, and a youth at the wooden table that split the kitchen in half, chopping onions and monitoring what smelled like bread. By the word, she was hungry. That bread smelled divine. And what was in those pots? Despite the absurdly early hour, the young man's merry prattling had echoed off the stones of the stairwell. But he'd fallen silent, both men stopping their work, when Rowan strode down the steps into the kitchen. The Fey Prince had been waiting for her down the hall, arms crossed, already bored. But his animal-bright eyes had narrowed slightly, as if he'd been half-hoping she would oversleep and give him an excuse to punish her. As an immortal, he probably had endless patience and creativity when it came to thinking up miserable punishments. Rowan addressed the old man by the hearth, standing so still that Selena wondered if the prince had learned it or been born with it.
"Your new scullery maid for the morning shift. After breakfast, I have her for the rest of the day."
Apparently, his lack of greeting wasn't personal. Rowan looked at her with raised brows, and she could see the words in his eyes as clearly as if he'd spoken them.
"You wanted to remain unidentified, so go ahead, princess. Introduce yourself with whatever name you want."
At least he'd listened to her that night. "Alentia," she choked out. "My name is Alentia." Her gut tightened. Thank the gods Rowan didn't snort at the name. She might have eviscerated him, or tried to, at least, if he mocked the name Nehemia had given her. The old man hobbled forward, wiping his gnarled hands on a crisp white apron. His brown woolen clothes were simple and worn, a bit threadbare in places, and he seemed to have some trouble with his left knee. But his white hair was tied back neatly from his tan face. He bowed stiffly.
"So good of you to find us additional help, Prince."
He shifted his chestnut-brown eyes to Selena and gave her a no-nonsense once-over.
"Ever work in a kitchen?"
With all the things she had done, all the places and things and people she had seen, she had to say no.
"Well, I hope you're a fast learner and quick on your feet," he said.
"I'll do my best." Apparently that was all Rowan needed to hear before he stalked off, his footsteps silent, every movement smooth and laced with power. Just watching him, she knew he'd held back last night when punching her. If he'd wanted to, he could have shattered her jaw.
"I'm Emrys,"
the old man said. He hurried over to the oven, grabbing a long, flat wooden shovel from the wall to pull a brown loaf out of the oven.
Introduction over. Good. No wishy-washy nonsense or smiling or any of that.
But his ears. Half-breeds. Peeking up from Emrys's white hair were the markers of his fey heritage.
And this is Luca,
the old man said, pointing to the youth at the work table. Even though a rack of iron pots and pans hanging from the ceiling partially blocked her view of him, he gave Selena a broad smile, his mop of tawny curls sticking up this way and that. He had to be a few years younger than her, at least, and hadn't yet grown into his tall frame or broad shoulders. He didn't have properly fitting clothes, either, given how short the sleeves of his ordinary brown tunic were.
You and he will be sharing a lot of the scullery work, I'm afraid.
Oh, it's absolutely miserable,
Luca chirped, sniffling loudly at the reek of the onions he was chopping.
But you'll get used to it, though maybe not the waking up before dawn part.
Emrys shot the young man a glare, and Luca amended, At least the company's good. She gave him her best attempt at a civilized nod and took in the layout again. Behind Luca, a second stone staircase spiraled up and out of sight, and the two towering cupboards on either side of it were crammed with well-worn, if not cracked, dishes and cutlery. The top half of a wooden door by the windows was wide open, a wall of trees and mist swirling beyond a small clearing of grass. Past them, the ring of megaliths towered like eternal guardians. She caught Emrys studying her hands and held them out, scars and all.
Already mangled and ruined, so you won't find me weeping over broken nails.
Mother, keep me. What happened?
But even as the old man spoke, she could see him putting the pieces together, see him deciphering Selena's accent, taking in her swollen lip and the shadows under her eyes.
Otterlin will do that to a person.
Luca's knife thudded on the table, but Selena kept her eyes on the old man.
Give me whatever work you want. Any work.
Let Rowan think she was spoiled and selfish. She was, but she wanted sore muscles and blistered hands, and to fall into bed so exhausted she wouldn't dream, wouldn't think, wouldn't feel much of anything. Emrys clicked his tongue. There was enough pity in the man's eyes that for a heartbeat, Selena contemplated biting his head off.
Then he said, Just finish the onions. Luca, you mind the bread. I've got to start on the casseroles.
Selena took up the spot that Luca had already vacated at the end of the table, passing the giant hearth as she did so, a mammoth thing of ancient stone, carved with symbols and odd faces. Even the posts of the brazier had been fashioned into standing figures, and displayed atop the thin mantle was a set of 9 iron figurines, gods and goddesses. Selena quickly looked away from the 2 females in the center, one crowned with a star and armed with a bow and quiver, the other bearing a polished bronze disc upheld between her raised hands. She could have sworn she felt them watching her. Breakfast was a madhouse. As dawn filled the windows with golden light, chaos descended on the kitchen, people rushing in and out. There weren't any servants, just weathered people doing their chores or even helping because they felt like it. Great tubs of eggs and potatoes and vegetables vanished as soon as they were placed on the table, whisked up the stairs and into what had to be the dining hall. Jugs of water, of milk, of the gods knew what were hauled up. Selena was introduced to some of the people, but most didn't cast a look in her direction. And wasn't that a lovely change, from the usual stares and terror and whispers that had marked the past 10 years of her life? She had a feeling Rowan would keep his mouth shut about her identity, if only because he seemed to hate talking to others as much as she did. In the kitchen, chopping vegetables and washing pans. She was absolutely, gloriously nobody. Her dull knife was a nightmare when it came to chopping mushrooms, scallions, and an endless avalanche of potatoes. No one, except perhaps Emrys with his all-seeing eyes, seemed to notice her perfect slices. Someone merely scooped them up and tossed them in a pot, then told her to cut something else. Then, nothing. Everyone but her two companions vanished upstairs, and sleepy laughter, grumbling, and clinking silverware echoed down the stairwell. Famished, Selena looked longingly at the food left on the work table, just as she caught Luca staring at her.
"Go ahead,"
he said with a grin, before moving to help Emrys haul a massive iron cauldron over toward the sink. Even with the insanity of the past hour, Luca had managed to chat up almost every person who came into the kitchen, his voice and laughter floating over the clanging pots and barked orders.
"You'll be at those dishes for a while, and might as well eat now."
Indeed, there was a tower of dishes and pots already by the sinks. The cauldron alone would take forever. So Selena plunked down at the table, served herself some eggs and potatoes, poured a cup of tea, and dug in. Devouring was a better word for what she did. Holy gods, it was delicious. Within moments, she'd consumed two pieces of toast laden with eggs, then started on the fried potatoes, which were as absurdly good as the eggs. She ditched the tea in favor of downing a glass of the richest milk she'd ever tasted. Not that she ever really drank milk, since she'd had her pick of exotic juices in Rifthold, but... She looked up from her plate to find Emrys and Luca gaping from the hearth.
"Gods above,"
the old man said, moving to sit at the table.
"When was the last time you ate?"
"Good food like this? A while. And if Rowan was coming back at some point, she didn't want to be swaying from hunger. She needed her strength for training. Magic training. Which was sure to be horrific, but she would do it. To fulfill her bargain with Maeve and honor her vow to Nehemia." Suddenly not very hungry, she set down her fork.
"Sorry," she said.
"Oh, eat all you like," Emrys said. "There's nothing more satisfying to a cook than seeing someone enjoy his food."
He said it with enough humor and kindness that it chafed. How would they react if they knew the things she'd done? What would they do if they knew about the blood she'd spilled? How she'd tortured Grave and taken him apart piece by piece, the way she'd gutted Archer in that sewer? The way she'd failed her friend? Failed a lot of people. They were noticeably quieter as they sat down. They didn't ask her any questions, which was perfect because she didn't really want to start a conversation. She wouldn't be here for long, anyway. Emrys and Luca kept to themselves, chatting about the training Luca was to do with some of the sentries on the battlements that day, the meat pies Emrys would make for lunch, the oncoming spring rains that might ruin the Beltane festival like last year. Such ordinary things to talk about, worry about. And they were so easy with each other, a family in their own way. Uncorrupted by a wicked empire, by years of brutality and slavery and bloodshed. She could almost see the three souls in the kitchen lined up beside each other. Theirs bright and clear, hers a flickering black flame.
"Do not let that light go out."
Nehemia's last words to her that night in the tunnels. Selena pushed around the food on her plate. She'd never known anyone whose life hadn't been overshadowed by Otterlin. She could barely remember her brief years before the continent had been enslaved, when Terrasen had still been free. She could not remember what it was like to be free. A pit yawned open beneath her feet, so deep that she had to move lest it swallow her whole. She was about to get started on the dishes when Luca said from down the table,
So you either have to be very important or very unlucky to have Rowan training you to enter Doranel.
Damned was more like it, but she kept her mouth shut.
Emrys was looking on with cautious interest. That is what you're training for, right?
Isn't that why you're all here?
The words came out flatter than she even expected.
Luca said,
Yes, but I've got years until I learn whether I've met their qualifications.
Years.
Years? Maeve couldn't mean for her to be here that long.
She looked at Emrys.
How long have you been training?
The old man snorted. Oh, I was about 15 when I came here, and worked for them for about 10 years. And I was never worthy enough. Too ordinary. Then I decided I'd rather have a home and my own kitchen here than to be looked down upon in Doranel for the rest of my days. It didn't hurt that my mate felt the same way. You'll meet him soon enough. He's always popping in to steal food for himself and his men.
He chuckled, and Luca grinned.
Mate, not husband. The Fae had mates, an unbreakable bond, deeper than marriage, that lasted beyond death.
Selena asked, So you're all half-breeds?
Luca stiffened, but flashed a smile as he said, Only the pure-blooded Fae call us that. We prefer demi-Fae. But yes, most of us were born to mortal mothers, with the fathers unaware they'd sired us. The gifted ones usually get snatched away to Doranel, but for us common offspring, the humans still aren't comfortable with us. So, we go here. We come to Mistward. Or to the other border outposts. Few enough get permission to go to Doranel that most just come here to live among their own kind.
Luca's eyes narrowed on her ears.
Looks like you've got more human in you than Fae.
Because I'm not half.
She didn't want to share any more details than that.
Can you shift?
Luca asked.
Emrys shot him a warning look.
Can you? She asked.
Oh no, neither of us can. If we could, we'd probably be in Doranel with the other gifted offspring that Maeve likes to collect.
Emrys growled.
Careful, Luca. Maeve doesn't deny it, so why should I? That's what Bass and the others are saying, too. Anyway, there are a few sentries here who have secondary forms, like Malachi, Emrys's mate. And they're here because they want to be.
She wasn't at all surprised that Maeve took an interest in the gifted ones, or that Maeve locked all the useless ones out.
And do either of you have gifts?
You mean magic?
Luca said, his mouth quirking to the side.
Oh, no. Neither of us got a lick of it. I heard your continent always had more wielders than we did anyway, and more variety.
Say, is it true that it's all gone over there?
She nodded. Luca let out a low whistle. He opened his mouth to ask more, but she wasn't particularly in the mood to talk about it. So she said, Does anyone at this fortress have magic? Maybe they'd be able to tell her what to expect with Rowan and Maeve.
Luca shrugged. Some. They've only got a hint of boring stuff, like encouraging plants to grow, or finding water, or convincing rain to come. Not that we need it here.
They'd be of no assistance with Rowan or Maeve, then.
Wonderful.
But, Luca chattered on, no one here has any exciting or rare abilities, like shape-shifting into whatever form they want, or controlling fire.
Her stomach clenched at that.
Or oracular sight. We did have a female wander in with raw magic 2 years ago. She could do anything she wanted, summon any element. And she was here a week before Maeve called her to Doranel, and we never heard from her again.
A shame.
She was so pretty, too. But it's the same here as it is everywhere else.
A few people with a pathetic trace of elemental powers that are really only fun for farmers.
Emrys clicked his tongue.